This edition of The Recap was first broadcast on the 15th of August 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello, I'm Ben Ryland and welcome to The Recap, bringing you the highlights from the past week's live news and analysis programs broadcast right here on Monocle 24. Over the next half hour, I'll bring you some of the very best interviews and reports from The Globalist, The Briefing, The Dory House and The Monocle Daily. Coming up, we'll look back at the week that was in Turkey, where a series of violent attacks had the nation on high alert.
No one is coming out yet and pinpointing this on anybody. However, I mean, in terms of any idea of this being synchronized, I think we can possibly say it's probably not synchronized at this stage.
We'll also turn our attention to the relationship between China and West Africa, as the Chinese foreign minister completed his tour of the region earlier in the week.
They're extending their assistance. And if you look at these sort of investment packages that they're talking about with Liberia, for example, building some roads, not only are those extremely useful, positive things to be built, but they're saying we're looking for partners to do them as well.
And later in the show, in the absence of any detailed policy ideas, how much of a role is branding playing in the Republican race to nominate for the White House?
Very frequently in American elections, there's somebody who's an outsider, somebody who says, I'm not a traditional politician, I'm going to come in and shake things up and tell these entrenched Washington interests what's what.
All that and much more coming up in the next half hour right here on The Recap with me, Ben Ryland. Starting off today, we're in Turkey, where a wave of violent attacks earlier this week rocked the country. Among them was a bomb blast in Istanbul and gunfire outside the city's US consulate. The rise in violence came as Turkey continued what it calls a synchronized war on terror, targeting the so-called Islamic State, Kurdish and far-left militants. Our Istanbul Bureau Chief Chris Lord was here in London this week. He joined Steve Bloomfield on Monday's edition of The Briefing.
What sort of began this night of violence really was a car bomb that went off outside a police station on the Asian side of Istanbul. That has, at the moment, the current toll of what's happened there has injured 10 people, of seven of which were police officers, and one police officer later died in hospital. Just as that was breaking the news, a gunfight then unfolded outside the US consulate on the European side of Istanbul at the same time, of which no one's been killed in that attack, but at the moment they're still kind of working out what's going to happen next in terms of who, there have been arrests have been made. And then down in the southeast, in Sirnak, a car bomb has killed five security personnel down there in the southeast of Turkey.
And so far, Chris, do the authorities think that all three of these attacks are linked? And if so, do they have any idea of who they think might be behind it?
No one is coming out yet and pinpointing this on anybody. However, I mean, in terms of any idea of this being synchronized, I think we can possibly say it's probably not synchronized at this stage. Mainly, the main reason being that one of the assailants in the gunfight outside the US consulate, she was arrested previously and has been arrested now, but she was previously arrested for being involved with the Revolutionary People's Liberation Army Front, which is a far leftist group that's active in Turkey. You might remember this story that came out about the prosecutor in Turkey that was actually held at gunpoint and by this group last month. And this is, you know, again, they're back in the news, this group that's, you know, kind of possibly launched this gun attack. But in terms of any kind of synchronized attack between these, no one's coming out and actually saying that. We only have to look back to August the 2nd. You know, the PKK had a car bomb that killed two soldiers in Turkey. So car bombs are really becoming this resurgence of violence by the PKK. Seems to be the weapon of choice at the moment for the PKK.
And to put this into context, Chris, obviously, as you say, there is the issue with the PKK. There is also the fact that Turkey has sort of rejoined the fight against ISIS across the border. And also at the same time, we still have this unresolved issue of what sort of government there's going to be in Turkey after the summer's elections.
Well, that's right. I mean, today, you know, with some sort of cruel fate about it, today was supposed to be the day that the AKP and the CHP, which are the two dominant, at least leading parties in any kind of coalition, were supposed to sit down today and do what they call the last big push for working out a coalition. And I mean, really now, this is going to throw everything into some degree of disarray. I mean, you know, in two major attacks in the second city, this is going to, you know, not going to just kind of, I don't think it's going to be business as normal today in Ankara. But I wanted to make one point as well, Steve, that Cemal Bayık, who's one of the top brass in the PKK. He was interviewed yesterday, a few days ago, by the BBC, and that interview went live overnight. And in that interview, he basically accuses Turkey directly of protecting Islamic State. And he also says that, you know, Erdogan is attempting to advance his aim of Turkishness in Turkey by this renewed fight, you know, this fight against what he says is actually a fight against the PKK and not Islamic State at all. Now, for that to go live overnight and then suddenly to see these wave of attacks take place in Istanbul, I mean, not to draw too many conclusions, but it has a certain, resonance about it.
Chris Lord there, speaking to Steve Bloomfield on Monday's edition of The Briefing. You're listening to The Recap on Monocle 24, now looking back to Monday's edition of Midori House. China's foreign minister finished a tour of West Africa this week, visiting countries hardest hit by the Ebola crisis that killed more than 11,000 people. China gave more than $100 million in aid to fight Ebola there, also sending hundreds of doctors. In this snippet from the program, Monocle's editor Andrew Tuck discussed China's involvement in West Africa with Isabel Hilton, editor of China Dialogue, and James Schneider, senior correspondent at New African magazine.
China has played a positive role in the Ebola crisis. It moved a lot faster than every other country other than Cuba in providing doctors and nurses that were sent over to man the Ebola facilities, which is exactly what was required. And that was a large part of how the virus then got under control, was when France, the US and the UK then basically copied this strategy and built quite large clinics and sent over a lot of medical personnel. So they get a lot of credit for that. I don't think you can see anything too malign in what they're doing now. They're extending their assistance. And if you look at these sort of investment packages that they're talking about with Liberia, for example, building some roads, not only are those useful, extremely useful, positive things to be built, but they're saying we're looking for partners to do them as well. So this road that's meant to run along the coast to go to Ivory Coast could very well end up being a, let's say, French-Chinese built road. It's a far more nuanced and far more collaborative role on the continent, at least with respect to a lot of big ticket things like Ebola, like infrastructure.
Isabel, do you agree? Do you think there's a maturing of the way that they use business and aid and, well, to win friends and do good things in the region?
Up to a point. And certainly the Ebola response was very good. And there has been a maturing of the Chinese position in several respects, but you also note that the minister criticized comments about corruption. And I think that, you know, this brings us back to the very early position of the Chinese, where they were going into countries where looking for resources, essentially. Now they're going into countries looking for resources and business. They have a lot of overcapacity that they need to export. And the deals are extremely opaque. And these are complaints from, you know, local press that they simply can't find out what the deals were. And when you say that outsiders are not allowed to comment on corruption, I mean, you are looking at things. There was a stretch of road in Sierra Leone, which the Chinese built, for which the government of Sierra Leone paid $18 million, which is a unit price of about $4.5 million a kilometre, when the standard international price for a stretch of road is $250,000. So clearly this is a deal in which the Chinese contractors and the government of Sierra Leone both benefited, but it's not very good for the people. So I think that I welcome all kind of maturing of the Chinese approach, but I think that we are still hitting a fundamental problem here in which the Chinese seek to gain a competitive advantage by not questioning the conduct of the government.
That was a highlight from Midori House, featuring Monocle's editor Andrew Tuck in conversation with Isabel Hilton and James Schneider. Not so long ago, the word Ferguson didn't really mean all that much. A football manager or a defunct television brand, perhaps. Now it's synonymous with a style of policing in the United States which results in the deaths of young black men. And a year on from the shooting of an unarmed teenager, Michael Brown, another young man from the Missouri town was in hospital with injuries from a police bullet. The incident came at the end of a day of commemoration for Michael Brown. Police say it involved criminals, not protesters, and they only opened fire after they had come under attack themselves. Afterwards, officers cleared the streets of Ferguson using tear gas, and St. Louis County declared a state of emergency. On Monday's edition of The Monocle Daily, Guy Delaunay and Andrew Muller spoke to Mary C. Curtis, a journalist who's been following the unfolding events in Ferguson.
Well, right now he is said to be in the hospital in critical condition, and he has been charged with the shooting. They said he was shooting at police officers. They were plainclothes police at the end of this day of protesters, and he was a protest. He was not a part of that protest. They say it was groups shooting at one another. And actually, right now, they have declared a state of emergency in Ferguson. It's kind of a sad reminder, a parallel 1 year out of progress, but then also, of course, you still have problems in Ferguson.
Let's talk about this progress, Mary, because when we're looking at the response of the authorities to this latest incident involving Tyrone Harris, and there were other shootings as well in Ferguson, and the police themselves had come out in body armour, they cleared the streets with tear gas, they were telling protesters they had to stay to the sidewalks and not be on the streets themselves. It didn't seem to be a lot of trust between the community and the police officers who are meant to be there to serve them, and yet the authorities are talking about trust which has been built up in the past year. How do you feel that any of these changes the authorities have been talking about really are?
Well, there, of course, are a lot of tensions. I believe if you ask many of the white residents of Ferguson, they'll say, well, we get along with our neighbors. And many of the black people in the area would say they're still being stopped because they so-called fit a description. They're still being unnecessarily policed in heavy ways. So you will get different stories. Now, there has been a black interim police chief put in place, an interim city manager, and a black judge has been appointed because, as you recall, there were charges that the Justice Department that did not charge Wilson, the officer who shot Darren Wilson, who shot Michael Brown, but they also had a scathing report of the area that said that they were using the poorest of citizens to collect fines to keep city government going. So they did put a new judge in. But there is so much problems, so many problems, and many of them are structural and historic. There have been articles that talk about the schools, the housing, segregated housing patterns, and also policing. And the police force is still overwhelmingly white.
Guy Delaunay and Andrew Muller there discussing the events in Ferguson, Missouri earlier this week on The Monocle Daily. This is The Recap on Monocle 24. Still to come, we'll look at the importance of branding in America's political race, we'll delve deeper into the mechanics of radicalization, and we'll hear about another presidential contest heating up in Argentina.
Who said print was dead? Certainly none of the guests who sit down with Tyler Brulé and Tom Edwards to dissect the best and brightest, glowing and glossiest in the magazine industry. Every Saturday at 10 a.m. London time, Studio One at Midori House can play host to art directors and publishers, photographers and columnists as they flick through their favourite journals, shred some of the periodicals they could do without, and dispense snippets of industry gossip.
Our paper is incredibly expensive and it's imported from Italy. And we had that discussion about the paper, but actually we decided the paper is too important. It's just too important that it looks good, that it's consistent. It's a little bit like hymn book paper, and it creates the impression that we've been around for a very, very, very long time.
Occasionally, they also offer up some sharp opinions on where this turbulent sector might be heading. Join Tyler Brulé or Tom Edwards when Tyler's on the road for The Stack, Monocle 24's weekly print industry review and analysis show, every Saturday at 10 a.m. London time. Make it part of your must-listen lineup on iTunes or SoundCloud.
You're listening to The Recap, a look back at our coverage of the week gone by in live news shows hosted right here on Monocle 24. I'm Ben Ryland. The process of choosing a presidential candidate in the USA often seems to play out like a very long episode of American Idol, though perhaps rather nastier. The current contest had been looking like another Clinton-Bush race for the White House, two very familiar names, until of course an altogether different name threw himself into the pot with an earth-shattering thud. Donald Trump, or the Donald as he's often known, has been busy registering political trademarks which are derivatives of his name. Expect to see t-shirts, buttons, and bumper stickers with the words such as Trumpublican and, perhaps more optimistically, Trumpocrat. But how much of the frenzy surrounding Trump's every word constitutes actual political commentary? He's famously dismissive of any detailed policy ideas. So given his thus far impressive polling results, is the current Republican nomination process simply an exercise in master branding? A grotesque extension, perhaps, of Trump's past work in reality television. Dr. Jacob Parakilis is Assistant Project Director for the US Project at Chatham House. He spoke to Tig Enright on Tuesday's edition of The Globalist.
In a way, Trump's brand is more divisive than Schwarzenegger's. Schwarzenegger made sure, I mean, he was a Republican, but he was married to a Kennedy, who are, of course, the sort of icons of the Democratic Party. He was a sort of pro-business, but socially relatively liberal Republican. I mean, he had clearly thought a great deal about how to position himself, even long before he started to run for governor.
The fact that, as we were saying there, it was for a while looking quite likely that we would have a Clinton-Bush race for the White House again. What was it, 1992 when we last
92,
had that?
92, yeah.
I mean, is that the kind of thing that when it comes to those American voters who hear or who consider kind of Washington this kind of faraway, meddlesome, annoying place where they're all on their political high horses, is that the kind of thing that makes the hairs stand up on the back of their neck and think...
Yeah, this is a long-running sort of antagonism, though. I mean, you just, you know, look back over the last series of elections. I mean, in 2012, Herman Cain and Newt Gingrich both had their sort of moment in the sun with polling numbers that look very much like Donald Trump's do today. 2008, Mike Huckabee was briefly in the lead. You had, you know, insurgent candidates like Pat Buchanan in 92, Steve Forbes, who I'm not sure Forbes actually ever was in the lead of the pack, but very frequently in American elections, there's somebody who's an outsider, somebody who says, I'm not a traditional politician. I'm going to come in and shake things up and tell these entrenched Washington interests what's what. More often than not, because of the expense of running for president, that person is very entrenched in their own industry and very, you know, has done very well from it. But, I mean, Trump is, he's the ultimate expression of this, not a sort of entirely new phenomenon, I would say.
Was it last time round when we all met Sarah Palin for the first time?
Two times ago. That was 2008.
Two times ago. Goodness, how memories fade.
How time flies.
You know, we do have these characters who can enter the race from pledging to be anti-establishment and, you know, taking it to those bureaucrats in Washington. They often turn out to be somewhat buffoonish. And I suppose we are perhaps, I wouldn't maybe seeing that a bit with Donald Trump, maybe. I don't think it's too much of a stretch to say that. I mean, who are they appeal? Even the people who support them, do they take them seriously?
I think there's a degree to which they're taken seriously. I mean, the thing to remember is that at this stage in the campaign, no one's actually voting. It's not a, you know, it's not a stage of the campaign where anyone's decision actually matters. It's just they're telling their pollsters, they're reflecting anger at the establishment, you know, by saying they'll vote for someone like Trump by showing up at his rallies. I mean, again, this is not a Trump phenomenon. This is a long-running American phenomenon.
Dr. Jacob Parakilis there, discussing the role of branding in politics with Tig Enright on The Globalist. You're listening to The Recap on Monocle 24. I'm Ben Rylan. Well, from one presidential contest to another. In Argentina, a first round of presidential elections are due to be held in late October. In primary elections held last Sunday, Daniel Scioli, the candidate representing the country's governing coalition, won a majority. It's likely at the moment that he's on track for winning the October elections as well. This will, of course, bring to an end the Kirchner era. The incumbent Cristina and her late husband Nestor, who have ruled Argentina for 12 consecutive years. On Tuesday's edition of Midori House, Tom Edwards discussed the country's evolving political dialogue with Roger Boyce, a longtime foreign correspondent and diplomatic editor for The Times of London, and Oscar Guardiola Rivera, senior lecturer at Birkbeck University of London and author of What If Latin America Ruled the World?
Well, he has a very good record as governor of the province of Buenos Aires, which matters in electoral terms because the province comprises close to 40% of the people who will be voting in the general election. If that is the case, then the poll results give us a very good view of what will happen. He has the support of Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner, the current president, he is seen, in spite of that, as also a bit of a reformer. He has been known to criticize the government while at the same time supporting its best achievements. And indeed, there seems to be a general feeling that the country under the Kirchners is better than it was 15 years ago. And that will be an important element in the elections.
Now, Roger, we're going to be talking actually a bit about Argentina, about Brazil as well, and all across Latin America. There's a lot of discussion about the need for, I guess, you know, reformist candidates, a reformist agenda. It's a part of the world that seems to be fairly tumultuous at the moment. Do you think there is a broad appetite, and is that what the rest of the world expects to see, candidates who are at least capable of selling the notion of change to their electorates?
Well, the incumbents are very largely, I mean, with certain exceptions like Colombia, are very largely leftist with redistributive policies. And the problem, of course, is that when the oil price drops and when commodity prices drop, there's not all that much to redistribute. So you're stuck. You're stuck with the rhetoric of populist movements and the inability to deliver. So that creates tensions. It creates tensions in the middle classes. It creates tensions anywhere where the constituency isn't firmly anchored in some kind of tribute system or provincial power structure. And that's what's happening. And then the other thing, of course, well, which we're seeing in Argentina, is that inflation, high inflation, really radicalizes. That's to say, it weakens loyalties in a certain way. So although, I mean, I bow to Oscar because he's the specialist, but I wouldn't necessarily say that the race is run yet in Argentina. Mm. I mean, there's quite a lot of maneuvering still going on, and it could be that Macri creeps in somehow, I'm not sure. But either way, I think the electorate is quite fluid, and I think that a 30% inflation rate makes it fluid.
Monocle's Tom Edwards there in conversation with Roger Boyce and Oscar Guardiola Rivera on Tuesday's edition of Midori House. This is the recap on Monocle 24. Now, barely a week goes by without Greece hitting the headlines yet again, and earlier this week, the country moved another step closer to a bailout deal that would stop the country going bankrupt. Part of the sticking points in the agreement included the creation of a new independent fund that will manage the privatization of the country's assets, and also the deregulation of the natural gas market. On Tuesday's edition of The Monocle Daily, Emma Nelson and Dominic Reynolds were joined by Constantine Bouhayer, author and overall Europe and Greece expert.
3 weeks ago, the drachma, which is a currency that does not exist, was the third highest mentioned currency in the news.
That's great.
That's amazing. And things were up in turmoil. Now, this is part of a timetable for reaching an agreement, and the Greek parliament and the Troika, now it's Quadriga, there's four of them, have been to Greece to negotiate the reforms which Greece needs to undertake in order for these billions, first one, this was a 3.2 billion euro and going up to 86 billion, to be handed over to Greece in order to pay back its debt. So it's a gradual process, and it's part of a lengthy timetable which extends to the end of next week.
You mentioned a lengthy timetable. These were lengthy negotiations. I mean, they obviously enjoyed the hospitality of the rooftop bar of the Athens Hilton for some time, and rightly so, it's a lovely place. But why did it take almost 23 hours for this to get sorted?
It's, in fact, I think it's just about on time by Greek standards, so let's not be too unkind to them. However, they did agree to it, and they, now that what needs to be done is for them to, there's a race, in fact. They have to pass it in Parliament before the Germans can get at it. And the Germans will be voting on this package next week. So if the Greeks can pass it through Parliament, then this will force almost the Germans to accept the agreement which has been reached, because they're the main obstacle in this progressing.
Okay, so there are quite a lot of elements that will need to be passed before that, aren't there? I mean, various things have jumped out at me. I was talking to Emma beforehand about one point, which is the tightening of the definition of who is a farmer.
I know.
Which struck me as something that raises more questions than answers, really. But, I mean, there are lots of elements that need to get put through. What are going to be the challenges, or just pick out some that you think we should know about?
Indeed, I've underlined that one under the term silly.
Good. It was definitely in my silly column as well. I'm glad I'm on the right lines.
How on earth do you define a farmer? Why do you have to define a farmer?
That's really the question.
A few years ago, the Greeks invited quite a few journalists, and one of the talks was given to us by another fellow Greek journalist, and he said, in Greece, you are what you declare. In other words, if you declare to be a farmer, you are a farmer. There's an acquaintance who is a teacher. However, 15 years ago, she used to be a bookseller because she helped her father. Now she's classified as a bookseller. And even though she's working for the state as a teacher, she has to go through a whole rigmarole of bureaucracy to change her title from bookseller, for which she's paying no taxes because she's not a bookseller, to a teacher, for which she's already being taxed. So that is the looseness of the definition. You are what you declare to be.
Emma Nelson and Dominic Reynolds there in conversation with Constantine Buhaya on The Monocle Daily. Well, we're nearly at the end of today's show, but before we depart, let's hear one more highlight from our Midori House program. One story making headlines this week exemplified why the so-called Islamic State might top the threat rankings of some US security officials. Two young newlyweds from Mississippi were accused of attempting to travel to Syria to join IS fighters. The pair, a 19 and 22-year-old, were arrested last Saturday while en route to the airport. On Wednesday's edition of Midori House, Steve Bloomfield discussed the mechanics of radicalization with James Boyce, political historian and author of the book Clinton's Grand Strategy, and Raffaello Pantucci, director of international security studies at the Royal United Services Institute, who himself has just written a book about radicalization across suburban Britain.
The difficulty is that there is no single path to radicalization. It's an individual process. Individuals decide that they've adopted these ideas and decide to go down these paths. I was actually reading the affidavit that came out that was associated with this case. And what's really interesting about it is because it all draws from their conversations with people who they thought were ISIS recruiters and radicalizers online, but in fact were FBI agents who were trolling the internet for people like this to go after. You know, and it's really interesting because actually in the sort of correspondence you see, they're really interested in trying to understand what this state is, and they want to go participate in this state. And they say, well, I can go there and I can be a media mujahid. I want to go participate in that side of it. And the girl says, I have some nursing training. I can come and help in that way. And they're really drawn by this whole narrative of going to build and construct this state. And I think that's a really interesting aspect, which we really should be careful to kind of miss when we focus a lot on when we talk about ISIS. We see this horrible group that's, you know, decapitating.
And it's about their hatred for
exactly.
us
and
rather than look at, well, there's an ideology here which, you know, we may not agree with, yeah, but that's what's drawing people in.
It really is. It's about building this utopian society, and it is apparently attracting a lot of these people. The other aspect, I think, if you're going to look at a sort of difference between what happens in the US and what happens here in the UK, for example, is that in the UK, and this is something that's changed over time, is it tends to be grouped in places and clustered around people. And we tend to see there's a substantial human dynamic as well, a sort of an online component. Whereas in the States, it's much more scattered around. And so we've seen lots of these cases in just really random places in the US. And that's much more about individuals being quite isolated.
Steve Bloomfield there in conversation with James Boyce and Raffaello Pantucci on Wednesday's edition of Midori House. And that brings us to the end of this week's edition of The Recap. The show was produced by me, Ben Ryland, and edited by Sam Impey and Nina Norick. Join us again next week to hear some of the very best of our live news programs right here on Monocle 24. Until next time, thanks for listening. Enjoy your weekend.